Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the health care they need. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, you're listening to Valley Edition. Today on our show, groundwater. We were the last Western state to regulate it, and today we evaluate how the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act is working. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Monica Velez. With the census coming in less than a year, we examine why so many San Joaquin Valley communities are hard to count, and what local groups are trying to do about it. We also talk foster care and speak with doctors trying to improve health care for the LGBTQ+ community.
But first, a recap of the week's news. The oil seep near the Kern County community of McKittrick continues to grow and has now exceeded 1 million gallons in size. Governor Gavin Newsom visited the site with agency representatives on Wednesday, and he told the press he's feeling optimistic, but we're not out of the woods yet.
We want to learn from this, and we'll get to the bottom of it, and we're going to make sure we tighten things up.
The seep is roughly a third crude oil, two-thirds brine, and it's contained within a dry stream bed. The cause is still unknown.
Newsom also visited Fresno County on Wednesday to sign into law the Safe and Affordable Drinking Water Fund, a pot of money available for the 300-plus communities that lack safe drinking water. The law guarantees funding through 2030.
Nothing in the budget makes me more proud than this. I'm dead serious about that. Some folks wonder why the hell you get in politics. This is the why.
Newsom signed the bill alongside local residents, legislators, and environmental justice advocates, including Dolores Huerta.
Fresno Unified School Board trustee Terry Sladek continues to be in hot water now that the school district has released its second investigation into his conduct. The report alleges the trustee was hostile, intimidating, and degrading while trying to get three wrestling coaches to cancel a joint practice they had scheduled with another school. The report concludes Sladek's behavior likely violates school board policy.
Listen for more FM 89 News every weekday during Morning Edition and All Things Considered. In 2010, you likely received a form from the Census Bureau. If you didn't send it back, then you were not counted as part of the population, which may have meant less federal funding for your community. But some local organizations are hoping the upcoming 2020 census could be your chance to change that. And we start the story in the southwest corner of Fresno County. The town of Huron isn't a place you just stumble upon. It's isolated and surrounded by miles and miles of fields.
It's a small farm working community for the most part. That's how I would describe it.
That's Aurora Ramirez. She grew up in Huron and still works here at a nonprofit community resource center. This laid-back but passionate advocate is driving me around town in her black Honda. We get to a dirt field that's just a short distance from a residential neighborhood. The road's rocky and bumpy. There's no clear pathway for cars or any type of sidewalk. But in the middle of the field, there's an old rundown warehouse.
That packing house has people living there. People are not going to assume that there is people living here, and there is.
And Ramirez says field workers have been living here for years. They use tin, tarps, cardboard, or whatever they can find to build a home. There are pockets of these makeshift homes all over town and the San Joaquin Valley. And they don't all have legitimate addresses, meaning the Census Bureau may not know people live there. So how did these people get counted in past censuses?
I don't think they do. They're seemed as if they're not even existing addresses. So then we, not only are we facing problems with people that don't have an actual address, but ones that have an address that is not considered a physical address.
That's one of the reasons Huron is considered a hard-to-count community. That means a significant portion of the population hasn't been accounted for in past census counts. And according to the Census Bureau, the San Joaquin Valley is home to some of the hardest-to-count places in the country.
I would say, generally speaking, hard-to-count communities tend to be people of color, low-income, immigrants, limited English proficient, children under five whose parents tend to fall under the categories that I just mentioned.
That's Cindy Quesada. She's a senior program officer for the center, a health advocacy nonprofit that's heading 2020 census outreach and research in parts of Central California. Through her research, Quesada found part of the challenge is getting people to understand participating is important because it impacts how communities are funded.
I would say that, you know, census data is used to, you know, to plan, right, for like where schools should be and how many schools should be in a, you know, particular section because it's based on population.
Then Quesada says most get on board. But Ellen Brav Guajardo says it's still a huge challenge. She's also with the center.
Passing out pencils or passing out pamphlets or, you know, PSAs about, hey, it's census time. That is not gonna work.
She says the census becomes what she calls an ethical dilemma for some people because they don't trust the government will keep their information private, especially after President Trump's push for a citizenship question on the census. That's when, she says, face-to-face conversations become important.
Being able to hear what their particular concerns are about, being able to give them some response to at least be able to make the case for why it's worth whatever they're perceiving as the risk, and really offering folks a helping hand.
The goal is to count as many people as possible. It's part of the state project, the California Complete Count, so that Californians get their fair share of federal resources and even representation, because it turns out the amount of political representatives depend on population. After the last census, the Valley got an additional state Senate seat, District 16, in part because of the census work the Dolores Huerta Foundation did. The executive director, Camila Chavez, says collaboration is key.
And I know that that's what helped us 10 years ago when it came to our work in Kern County, is that we were working with our census partners as well as other community groups to get the word out.
The foundation received national recognition after the 2010 census for increasing the response rate in hard-to-count communities in rural Kern County. Chavez says the foundation and other partners are continuing to use the method they know that works, going door-to-door and having one-on-one conversations with people.
It is tedious. It is difficult, especially in the Central Valley where we live in, you know, rural communities. The houses are spread out far apart, and then the heat, you know, doesn't help when you're out there. We are able to recruit volunteers who understand the importance of this and speak to their neighbors. It's so key.
Fireball Council member Felipe Perez joins us on our last stop in Huron. He says art is helping promote the census too.
Try to make some murals showing the importance about the census 2020 with some kind of picture as worker, field workers, and you're gonna see right now the first one that we are doing it over here in Huron.
The mural is only partially done. The words 2020 census hang above the farmers' fruits and vegetables that are sketched out. Perez's murals are going to be painted in other communities too, so people all over the valley can look at them and ask themselves, why does the 2020 census matter to me? With Valley Public Radio News, I'm Monica Velez.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Carrie Klein. Across Fresno and Madera counties, about 2,600 kids are currently in foster care. And although foster parents, attorneys, social workers, and judges all work together to move cases through the court system, an organization called CASA connects foster youth with volunteers who try to make sure their needs are met. Volunteers are also known as CASAs, which stands for Court-Appointed Special Advocates, but the organization argues there aren't nearly enough volunteers to fill the need. To learn more, FM89's Laura Satsui sat down with Jason Williams from CASA and three advocates, Wendy Shepherd, Robert Clark, and Kalina Goodman.
So to start, let's go to you, Jason. You're the advocacy manager for CASA Fresno Madera Counties. How do you explain the role of CASA, the organization, when you're just out talking to the community?
So the mission of CASA of Fresno Madera Counties is to recruit, train, and support volunteers from the community to advocate and mentor kids in foster care.
All right. And so give us a sense of what the need is here. How many foster kids are there in those two counties? And maybe what's the breakdown of support that they have?
So right now, I pulled very recent data from April of 2019. There are about 2,600 kids in foster care in Fresno, Madera counties. It's about 2,300 in Fresno and about 300 in Madera. And so basically those are kids who have been removed from their family or their care provider for abuse or neglect, and they have the needs of a regular child, but they also have the needs of a child who has been through trauma that necessitated the removal of them from their families.
And so when that child will end up with a foster family, presumably, or a foster parent, there's, you know, a social worker assigned to their case. And can you talk a little bit about what the spread, how many, you know, kids does a social worker work with? How many kids does a CASA advocate work with? That kind of thing.
Yeah. So that's part of the difficulty is that, so with 2,600 kids in Fresno Madera, each social worker probably has a caseload of around 20 to 30 kids. So if you can imagine, trying to manage an entire life of 30 kids is pretty complicated. And then each of our court systems, we have four judges total. So we have three judges in Fresno and one judge in Madera. So that those three judges are responsible for those 2,300 kids in Fresno. And then each of the attorneys, so each child does get represented by an attorney. And each of those attorneys, unfortunately, we have about five or six attorneys in Fresno. So again, if you do the math, that's upwards of 400, 500 kids per attorney. So our advocates are very fortunate that they are assigned to either one child or one sibling set. So that's kind of the magic of CASA, is that we have one person that can focus on one kid at a time, or one person that can focus on a sibling set and really make sure that their needs get met.
And turning now to the advocates in the room, Wendy, Robert, and Kalina, I want to ask, first of all, what drew you to getting involved with CASA? Kalina, maybe we'll start with you.
I am a teacher, and I have seen kids go through the foster care system. So when CASA came to talk to our district, it sounded like a really good way to do more. There's such a need, and I just felt like what I could do didn't end with the school day.
And so when was that? How long have you been involved?
I've been involved in CASA for 3.5 years.
And then Wendy and Robert, what about the both of you?
My education is in early childhood development. And so I came across CASA through another friend and a Facebook post. And I decided it was something that I wanted to look into. And when I jumped into it, I was just amazed at the need that is out there. And so I decided this is it. I want to jump in and try and make a difference.
And so I've been involved in many local outreaches through the churches that I've attended, and just really see a need for helping youth. And so when Wendy came up with that idea, I went ahead and looked into it, saw what it was all about, just saw where I could help.
And so, Jason, what is expected of advocates? If someone, you know, like Wendy and Robert pretty recently say, oh, this looks cool, like maybe I want to get involved, what are they in for?
They're in for a lot. So the first step is to come to an information session. So we do a 60 to 90 minute information session so that people can just kind of get a little bit of more information about what the expectations are. They have to do a background check. They get fingerprinted. They come to our training. Our training is really intense and comprehensive. Right now, it's 40 hours of training. The state requires 30 hours from all CASA organizations, and we just feel that our training, when we give 40 hours of training, we still have people that leave wanting more, and they just really are surprised about how much they didn't know. I think Wendy might even be able to attest that even having education with child development, there's still so much that we just don't know, because the foster care system is intentionally behind this curtain of confidentiality. So we try and teach people about the judicial dependency court system, foster care, child development, mental health. We talk about culture because, again, there's so much culture in Fresno and Madera specifically. So we try and scratch the surface on teaching people about different cultures. So our requirement is the 40 hours of training. And then once you become an advocate, you have to write a court report. Every 6 months, there's a hearing with the court system. And so you have to write a court report. And then we expect you to see your children or your child at least once a month. There will be meetings throughout the child's life. So if there's educational meetings, we would ask that you can attend those. And just really building a relationship with a child. We encourage folks that the more time you can spend with your child, the more you're going to know about them and the more you're going to be able to tell the judge about their circumstances. And that's what the judges want. They want as much information so that they can make a really informed decision about what's going to happen for that child.
And so, Kalina, as an educator, seeing kids going through your school as well, so how much more is this for you? Can you talk about a little bit the challenges? Did you know what to expect, or has it been totally different from what you thought it might be?
I didn't know what to expect going in, but the training really helped with that and adding to the knowledge that I already had as a teacher. Some of the skills are transferable from being a teacher to helping in the foster care system, working with a lot of professionals to get children's needs met. That's what I do every day at work. And so CASA feels like an extension of that sometimes, just to be able to meet the needs of more kids. But this is on an individual basis, so I feel like I'm able to do more and address specific needs resulting from them being in foster care as well.
And you're just working with one child, right?
I work with a family set or one child. So I've done both. I'm on my fourth case right now. So I've done two where I worked individually with one child and two where I've worked with a sibling set.
And I know, Robert and Wendy, you're working with a family right now, the both of you together. And so for you guys, what has maybe been challenging or something you didn't expect?
I think I thought the system would work a particular way, and once I got involved, I was not shocked by the circumstances of the case. It was the system and the approach to it, I think, is the difficulties that we have encountered.
So the system being like the Department of Social Services, the judicial system?
Yes.
Robert, what about you? Is that something you felt as well?
I think resources is a big deal, and kids want to be seen. Kids want to be heard. And unfortunately, in the system, they get lost. Resources are a big deal because sometimes the home or family, the mom and dad, don't have the resources that maybe foster care provides or can provide. So it may or may not hinder reunification.
And going back to you, Wendy, I mean, is there something specifically within the system or the systems that these kids are in that you think that you could point out that should be improved or changed?
There's a timeline that is in place that if reunification has not happened, I believe 18 months, then you are to stick within that timeline. And unfortunately, I've seen where a child wants to be reunified with their parent at the end of the 18 months. And what we're up against is, well, I'm sorry, you're out of time. And trying to advocate if we could just give a little more time for this case, it would be in the best interest of the child. But we are up against a system that says you are out of time.
And Robert, to what you said about resources, I think that makes me think, I want to point out that the advocates here are volunteers. You're not doing this because you're getting paid. You're doing it just out of the goodness of your heart. And so I wonder, Jason, running CASA, an organization like that, you're a nonprofit, but the need is so great. You know, can you talk a little bit about the challenges of meeting the needs for all the kids in Fresno Madera counties?
Oh, gosh. It is a huge struggle. We are mainly grant funded. At times, we're able to get funding from the county, from Fresno County, but that is never a guarantee. And grants are also not a guarantee. And it is a huge challenge because we are asking people to come and be volunteers. It's a lot of work that we're asking of people. So when we have volunteers, we really try and value them and the work that they're doing because we're not paying them. And we even joke with them, hey, if you don't do this report, we're going to cut your pay. And they're like, oh, great. What are you going to cut from zero? But the value in that for when an advocate is able to share with the kid that I'm actually just volunteering this. I'm doing this out of the goodness of my heart. I'm doing this because I care. It's really interesting with some of the kids where it just blows their minds. They just don't understand because everyone that's ever been involved, whether it is a great teacher or a great social worker or a great attorney, they know, these kids know that those people are being paid to be there. And so when they come across someone who actually just wants to spend time with them and be their voice, it's really interesting to see the kids deal with that and understand that. And I think that really goes a long way to build trust, because they've had so many social workers that just quit or they move on. And it's really hard for them to understand that. But again, that's the whole point of hopefully our advocates will see them through all of those other transitions and be there when the social worker goes away or they have to change schools or they have to change foster homes. But it's a constant conversation at CASA is how are we going to maintain our funding so that we can continue to do this important work. And we are such a unique organization. There aren't a lot of organizations that are actually working with foster youth specifically. And again, just the ability to provide an adult who is going to rebuild that kid's attachment to adults who have traditionally let them down in a lot of situations.
I think this is a good moment to ask if any of you advocates have any significant memories or anecdotes that you could share about working with your kids. Colleen, do you have something?
Jason talked about the turnover of adults in their lives. And one moment that I had with one of my children, he had been in foster care for less than a year. He was moving to his 10th home in that year, and they were picking him up from school. He wasn't even returning to the foster home he had been at previously. His items were in literal trash bags in the back of the car, and the social worker who was taking him to the new home had never met him before. And the new home had never met him before. There are so many people that are working in the system that have kind hearts and good intentions, but there's still cracks. And this was one of those moments where he would have fallen through the crack. To move a child with no connections to anybody, that's how it would have gone down had CASA not been there. But I was able to go with him. I had been working with him for about 6 months at this point, and I was able to say, hey, this is a new and exciting experience for you. I think this will be a better place for you. I'm the only one that knows you here. And I was able to go with him to his new foster placement. In addition to that, that day was his birthday. And to be moving homes and schools and have your things in trash bags in the back of a car with strangers, people you've never met, and it be your birthday, you need somebody there. For a small child, this is the most important thing, just to be able to say, happy birthday. I'm glad you're here. I'm glad you're a person. I'm glad that you exist in this world and you're worth it.
And you were the person to say that.
And I was the person to be able to be there with so many well-intended people. The turnover is so high and these connections are so short that CASA can be that lasting influence on their lives is really valuable.
Robert and Wendy, what about you guys? Any a significant moment or a memory?
Well, I think we've encountered a few with our particular family. One of the great moments was when Robert and I stopped by for a meeting, you know, to check on the family, see how they're doing, if there's anything that we needed to assist them with. And the children light up and they're calling out our names and they're happy to see us. And they were on a visit with mom and mom is happy to see us. And I think that touches your heart and it can get very emotional because you realize you've become this light in their life. They're depending on you. And they have developed a relationship with you. And I think that, in a sense, is compensation for volunteering with CASA just right there, is that they are relying on you and they are very excited to see you when you come to see them.
It's great to see kids out of an environment that is filled with chaos at times. It's great to see them put in a different environment and watch them just be kids.
I want to thank you all for the work you do, and thank you all for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
That was Laura Satsui speaking with Jason Williams, Wendy Shepherd, Robert Clark, and Kalina Goodman. For those interested in becoming advocates, there's a training coming up in October, and information can be found at casafresnomadera.org. A few weekends ago, a downtown Fresno nonprofit called Common Space teamed up with local health organizations to run a mobile health clinic specifically for the LGBTQ plus community, and they brought doctors in training to teach them cultural sensitivity. As for how providers could learn to better serve the LGBTQ plus community, I spoke with two of the doctors who ran the program, starting with Kenny Bond, an emergency room physician at UCSF Fresno and Community Regional Medical Center.
I am not an expert in transgender care or LGBTQ+. I have my own training, but as an emergency physician, I try to be culturally competent, but I'm doing general medical care. So when Dr. Nicole, who actually does this, comes in and has a specific patient population coming in here, I'm learning as much from them of not just how to address them, but what kind of special needs they have and kind of what are the barriers to care for them. I'll learn that there are some patients that are transgender, get hormone injections, but they're scared to inject themselves. So they're fearful of doing their self-injections. So we're working on seeing if we can get an injection clinic specifically so that patients that once we establish them and give them their meds, but they're scared of needles and sticking themselves, that we can actually help them through that process. So that's something I didn't know before I was started the first clinic, but these are things you learn as you go.
Right, like it's not enough to just hand them a bag with the proper, you know, medication, the syringes. It's, you know, you need to break down more barriers than that.
Absolutely. I think the general public, I think most physicians know that almost the least important part of medical care is writing that prescription. But many people think of physicians as that's their job. But it seems like that is the end point of many things, but that's only if you're not addressing all the barriers to care, if you're not going into why they need it, if you're not integrating in and figuring out about them, then you can't come to the diagnosis and get the resources that you need in order to affect care. Your total health, probably 20% is actually physician care, right? If you don't have access to safe spaces, clean drinking water, clean air, if you're worried about your next meal, if you're worried about being assaulted or drug exposure at your house, those are hard to think about controlling your diabetes and eating a healthy diet. There's things that we have to really realize as physicians, which we are learning and training, but we're hopefully also teaching the next generation down here, that we have to really be aware if we want to impact change.
Yeah, tell me about, I mean, what's different about a clinic like this, you know, coming here to serve the LGBTQ plus community versus something you'd bring to maybe a homeless or a transitional care sort of area? Like, what are the differences in needs?
What people don't realize is they think about these big things, these complex problems. But honestly, most of these patients are just actually looking for physicians that are culturally competent and sensitive to their needs. And it's basically understanding that human beings are human beings. However you're born, whatever race, whatever ethnicity, whatever gender assignment you're at or you believe you're at, it's not about that. It's about treating people like humans. And I think in certain communities, like in this community, they sometimes have not felt that with the medical community. So I say that half of our job is taking care of them, but the other half is really just endearing trust in the community to know that there are people that care about you and you should be treated like a human being.
Yeah, talk more about that cultural competency, because I imagine at least for, you know, the listeners or people who will see the story who are perhaps cis, heterosexual, you know, they'll say, oh, well, you know, physicians are physicians. I mean, what is there that isn't right? You know, what are some of the gaps that you've seen in some medical care, and then how do you aim to sort of combat those?
Well, there's a couple things you look at. If you look at the LGBT community in general, certain things spike in their population. We talked about HIV, but you talk about like some mental health diseases, drug abuse, domestic violence. These are much higher rates, so we have to be very sensitive to this patient population. The second part is because they have not always had medical care that's culturally competent, they often don't seek care. So the classic thing is that they have a lot of medical problems that are basically unaddressed, and they hide from them, and they wait for things to culminate and be, you know, like very end stage and very expensive to fix instead of doing preventative care. So we're trying to make sure that we're reaching out to initiate preventative care for these patients. So it's not always about this, like, oh, we say something that is special or using gender appropriate terms. Of course, we're going to do that. But it's always, I think it's the most important thing is basically being open and basically understanding.
So this is the second time that this clinic has come to Common Space. Have there been other instances of this LGBTQ plus preventive care elsewhere in the community here before, or is it just these two times so far?
This is only the second time for medical aspects. So what has happened is Common Space is a nonprofit that tries to group other LGBTQ-friendly services together, and they do everything from cultural to art to social, you know, as support groups. So what we're trying to do is trying to use already gathering centers and bringing the medical aspect to it. So yes, as my understanding, this is the second time pretty much it's ever happened in Fresno. UCSF Fresno used to have a transgender LGBT clinic down in Selma many years ago, but we lost the physician that was running it. So many years ago, we were the only LGBTQ plus specific transgender clinic in the Valley. Dr. Nicole actually is one of two providers that actually does a transgender clinic in the Valley. But the one catch, and she's volunteering her time with us here, is that she only sees insured patients at her own practice. And so she's using this avenue in order to see the percentage that are uninsured or need to get enrolled, and we can kind of take care of them regardless of what their insurance background is.
Bond mentioned another physician at the clinic, Dr. Nicole. That's Julie Nicole, a private practice OBGYN who specializes in transgender patients. She's one of the few providers to offer gender reassignment surgery in the San Joaquin Valley.
I think that as physicians, we like things that are uncomplicated. So if we take annual exams, for example, we would rather deal with patients that we know very well, that, you know, we have almost a family relationship with, that we can talk and catch up with the year. And we don't like to, we're comfortable in things that we know. And I think with transgender patients, it's yet another thing that we need to learn. I draw a parallel with Zika virus. When Zika virus arrived and we had to take care of pregnant women and being careful with the Zika virus, we felt like, oh my God, it's another thing we have to learn. And I feel a lot of providers are kind of overwhelmed by, oh, this is another thing we have to learn, where in fact it is really, really, really simple to provide good care to the trans population. So, and how I became interested in that field, I mean, there's the how I became interested in that field and why am I interested in that field. And the how is because as a first year medical student, I saw a documentary called Transgeneration. And it was following the life of four college students going through transition. And in that documentary, there was a young woman who went for her surgery in Trinidad, Colorado. Surgery was done by an OBGYN. I contacted that OBGYN, and I did a rotation as a med student, a rotation as a resident. And after residency, I joined her practice for about 14 months. So that was all before my move to Fresno. I left her practice to move to Fresno. And the why is that, you know, I was kind of a non-traditional student. I was a single mom in medical school, kind of an underdog. And I feel that this is a patient, you know, they are underdogs. They are neglected. They don't have a lot of support. They are very misunderstood, but it's such a rewarding field.
Yeah, tell me more. Rewarding how? You know, how do you feel, you know, as someone who serves this population and right. when you come out of a procedure or just even right. a regular appointment, you know, how do you feel that?
Well, you know, you take somebody who had been, you know, not misunderstood, but, you know, when they arrive to come and see me for, let's say, hormone replacement therapy, it's a big step for them. And you literally have them cross this bridge, you know. You're changing their software, you know, the hormone software from male to female. And it is such a relief. Like 99% of the time, my patients feel tons better after, you know, a few months after treatment. And they're like, oh, my voice drop or my breasts are growing. And it's such a huge weight lifted off their shoulder. And you see that every day. Yeah, like you get people well.
And so in order to administer hormones properly and do these gender reassignment surgeries, I mean, does that require extra training? And are there like specific concentrations or fellowships where you can get that? Or do you have to do what you did and specifically seek out providers right. who are already doing it?
Well, I think right now it's getting easier. There is now fellowships for surgeries that are being made available for individual or graduating from gynecology, urology, plastic surgery. So there's a few fellowship. There's also fellowship in mental health for psychiatrists. And this is pretty new in the past 5 years or so. The WPATH, which is the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, makes available, they have programs for surgeon mental health professionals. So the education is much present than when I started to do this over 10 years ago. I was lucky because I had, in my residency program, I had great support from the reproductive, endocrine, and infertility department. And they were very supportive and we kind of got trained together.
And of course, you're talking about, relatively specialized care, hormone, surgeries, or, talking kind of the trans population. But of course, there's, another goal here is to provide kind of more general preventive care.
Right.
What do you see as the gaps or the barriers in terms of, the medical community providing preventive care to the LGBTQ community?
Well, I think, we tend to be very heteronormative. When we arrive at an OBGYN, like how many times people are asked, hey, do you need birth control? But it's not every woman, depending on their relationship status. So I tend to ask, like, are you in a situation where you need birth control? So being conscious that it's not everybody is heterosexual. And I think that's a gap. And I found that the LGBT community in general have to educate their providers more than providers need to provide guidance and counseling to them.
And and talk about gender pronouns too. How that may seem like a very simple thing, but people make gaffes all the time. And how do you approach that issue when you're meeting a new patient for the first time?
Well, I ask. If you're not sure, you ask. I wear a little button with my pronouns, so that make it easy. But it's one of the very first questions I ask my patient. What's your name? And what are your pronouns? And, recently at the Community Medical Regional, we went through this huge upgrading of our electronic medical record. And that included a module that includes better description of sexual orientation and gender identity. So not only we have people with the right pronouns in the system, but we have what organs they have and what are their plans for transition.
That was emergency medicine physician Kenny Bond and OBGYN Julie Nicole.
You're listening to Valley Edition. I'm Monica Velez. When California adopted the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act in 2014, it became the last Western state to regulate its groundwater. If local groundwater agencies failed to submit plans to the state by 2020, the law says state water agencies could take over management of groundwater, a resource that's critically important to Valley agriculture. Moderator Kathleen Schott got an update on how the work is progressing locally from Gary Serrato with the North Kings Groundwater Sustainability Agency, Christina Beckstead with the Madera County Farm Bureau, and David Orth with New Current Water and Land.
So, Dave, let's start with you. You worked on the development of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, and I'm curious, what was the intent of that series of legislation? Why was it important for groundwater to be regulated in California?
Well, the act was basically became concepts in 2013 at the tail end of the last multi-year drought, where we were seeing an increasing rate of well failures. Groundwater elevations were dropping, significant development in areas where we knew groundwater was constrained. And as a result, both some of the lead California water agencies and the state legislature began to recognize that we needed to do something different with respect to the management of groundwater. And so the act came together through kind of a combination of policy considerations, and then that morphs into legislation to create a venue where local agencies involved in water management and land use were charged to come together and develop these plans that would move us away from just annual average overdraft and overuse of a finite resource into a sustainable management strategy, within a reasonable management and planning period.
Great. So I'd like to shift over to Gary, the executive officer of the North Kings Groundwater Sustainability Agency. Tell us a little bit about who are the players involved on the local level, and what is the work that you're currently doing?
Well, if you look around the table in terms of where the North Kings GSA moved to, we wanted to be all inclusive. And being all inclusive meant we need to get the land planners, those that had water supplies, and so we had the city of Fresno, the city of Clovis, the county of Fresno, and we have small water purveyors around the table as well too, and irrigation districts, and so we have a well-rounded board that represents all those different areas. And in addition to that, the Irrigation District, Fresno ID, has a board member who is actually the chair of that board as well, too.
And what exactly is this agency tasked with doing?
We're tasked with developing the plan. How are we going to become sustainable? The Central Valley was basically designated as a critically overdrafted basin, and so we have a shorter time period to develop a sustainable plan. And so we developed subgroups. We developed a technical committee, an outreach committee, to go out and go do the things of gathering the information, gathering the data to develop the plan to make sure that we're going to be sustainable. And so that was the charge of this particular group, and I can tell you so far we've done a pretty good job.
So I want to put a pin on this idea of sustainability, because that is not necessary. How sustainability is defined is going to vary from district to district. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So I want to get back to that in just a minute, but first I want to switch to Christina Beckstead, who's with the Madera County Farm Bureau. What are you hearing from farmers in Madera County as it pertains to this change in groundwater sustainability?
There's a lot of concern within the growers in Madera County, in that Madera County is, it's not unique in this respect, but we'll say 50% of the basin is a wide area. So essentially that's an area that does not have any surface water deliveries. So because of that, there's a whole governance structure that's completely different than most of the other areas. But that being said, the amount of water that needs to be reduced just in that area, 50% of the county, if you will, agriculture is an economic driver in Madera County, so it's a huge hit to them. So they're trying to figure out how to work together with all of the other agencies. As a whole, the growers are trying to come up with creative solutions and finding creative solutions, creative ideas to find these creative solutions to figure out how to move water around or to get additional surface water supplies. And then you have those that are just trying to figure out how do we do this economically in phasing it out, finding the right approach, because it's not an all or nothing deal from day one. It has to be something that has to be spread out over time, over the extent of implementation, if you will, in order for it to not kill the county off immediately.
So for people who aren't actively involved in agriculture, I think there's this perception that water just materializes. The state figures out a way to bring the water in to keep the industry going. What is the potential impact for agriculture in Madera County under this act?
So I have some numbers, but they haven't been released, so I can't share that with you. But as a Central Valley, they're looking at potentially a million acres of fallowed land. There's a shortage of about 2.5 million acre feet of water that's needed within the Central Valley. So that's a huge number.
So, Dave Orth, explain the logic here. Why is this preservation of groundwater worth that degree of economic impact for the valley?
Well, as we looked at groundwater use in 2013, 2014, it's clear that we're overdrafting. And so the question became, as a matter of policy and law, do we want to let the overdraft continue until we have winners and losers, people who can afford to go deeper, and all of the risk and damage that comes along with kind of an uncontrolled, unmanaged overuse of groundwater? Because at some point, we'll lose the groundwater. It's a finite resource. Or through the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, could we plan and develop a strategy that enabled the local agencies to map their own fate, to include the input from the stakeholders, the farmers and the communities, to define what do we want to do to get ourselves to a place where we either develop additional water supplies, and there are opportunities in the valley to capture floodwaters that are currently not beneficially used and put them back into the ground or use them in lieu of groundwater pumping. An unknown part of the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act is a call to the state, the legislature, and the administration to make more investments in infrastructure that lead to water supply reliability. It's not just about reducing groundwater use, but even with those things added to the portfolio, it's pretty clear that we have allowed the production or the development and pumping of groundwater to produce crops in some areas that cannot sustain and have no other alternative but to cut back. And from a planning perspective, it made more sense to the policymakers and the legislature to try to map out a roadmap, if you will, to sustainable use rather than just let it become what a lot of people call the tragedy of the commons, that we would just overuse and there would be winners and losers.
So, Gary Serrato, tell us a little bit. Let's get back to this idea of sustainability. How is North Kings defining sustainability? And how are you making that, coming to that conclusion?
Well, if you take a look at the Fresno Irrigation District, who is a huge partner in this GSA, the North Kings GSA, we have for years been doing conjunctive use projects. That means that we are capturing water supplies that when they're being flood released and we're able to capture them, put them back into the underground. We have constructed groundwater recharge facilities. We have constructed groundwater banking facilities. And then in addition to that, the cities of Fresno and Clovis have also constructed surface water treatment plants. That's where they take water from the river directly into the plant, treat it, and then take it back out to the household. We got to remember that in the Central Valley, most of the cities take their water from the ground. So they're being affected by this as well, too. So it's not just farmers, it's our cities, and it's our smaller communities as well, too, that are referred to as the disadvantaged communities. And so we've got to work with all of those to do all of these projects, and we've done that. We've partnered with Clovis. We partner with a small community of Biola to do that as well, too. There's grant funding out there that the state provides us that we go after to help those communities because it's difficult for those smaller communities to come up with the funding to do the infrastructure that's needed for them to be sustainable.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Valley Edition. We are talking about the Sustainable Groundwater Management Act, which is radically shaping the way the Central Valley will deal with groundwater resources. I'd like to shift the conversation back to Christina with the Madera County Farm Bureau. So what are you hearing from farmers in terms of their long-term sustainability? Obviously, we've already discussed there are a lot of efforts underway to find alternative resources and alternative ways to access water to support agriculture. But do you anticipate that there are going to be some farms that just fold or attempt to go out of state? What are you hearing?
So some of that's already happening. But ultimately, at least in Madera County, demand reduction is we know it's inevitable. What that looks like, that's going to depend on what projects come out. There's a lot of the GSAs already have projects that they've already implemented. Or
and just when you say GSA, that's the Groundwater Sustainability
Agencies. Yes. And we get tied up in the acronyms because we use them every day. But yes, the GSAs, the Ground Sustainability Agencies, there's multiple in Madera County. A lot of them already have projects that they've already implemented in the last few years. They have the intent of implementing new ones, and I think it's going to be a matter of how all of the projects come together and as they work as one. You know, there's a lot of focus on their individual management areas, if you will, within SGMA, and how that infrastructure is going to impact. But at the end of the day, I think it all comes back to everyone working together and linking together those infrastructure projects to make the county as a whole a better area for groundwater management, if you will.
Great. And you mentioned SGMA, which is the acronym for the act itself that's yes. driving all of this change. Dave, tell us a little bit about what kind of deadlines are we looking at here?
Under SGMA, the groundwater basins that have been defined by the state, and there are 517 of them, those that are critically overdrafted have to submit a groundwater sustainability plan to the California Department of Water Resources for review by January 31st, 2020. Under the Act, that plan has to include a 20-year roadmap to achieve sustainability by the end of that initial planning period, or January 31 of 2040. There are 21 critically overdrafted sub-basins in the state. Virtually all of them are in the San Joaquin Valley. The remaining basins, and there's about another 100 or so that have to do plans by, they have a two-year, they have a two-year extension, if you will, so their plans are due in January of 2022 with a 2042 sustainability deadline.
Great. So this is a fairly basic question, but can you explain what the geological impact of groundwater use has been in the San Joaquin Valley?
Complicated question, but decades ago, the State Department of Water Resources began mapping our groundwater resources. They fall into kind of two general categories. One is a deep aquifer that is confined with overlaying clay layers, and then above those clay layers, there are shallow aquifers. In that geology, some of the soils are permeable enough that we can recharge them, and some of the soils are so thick that you can't get water back into the ground, basically because of confining clays or other geologies that prevent recharge. What has happened over time is that we've tapped the confined or the deep aquifer and pumped excessively to the point that we've dewatered the clays, compacted the clays, and created what is called subsidence. Subsidence causes roads to buckle and wave.
Damage to infrastructure.
And damage infrastructure. The poster child for subsidence, if you will, right now is a significant reduction in capacity of the Frank Kern Canal at the Pixley area that has reduced the canal capacity by about 50% and significantly limiting what water can move further south into the San Joaquin Valley. And unless we put a check on those pumping rates, the subsidence will continue to create that kind of damage across conveyance, transportation, gas lines, you know, systems will just stop operating.
Gary, I'd like to bring you into the conversation, and my question is, how is this going to impact domestic well owners? We've talked a lot about agriculture, but what about property owners who have wells? What about low-income groups who often are left out of these conversations when we're dealing with big ag?
Well, quite honestly, the Act requires us to reach out to those folks, okay, and we have done that. And any time you've come in and tried to explain the Act to folks, they don't take it very well at the very beginning, you know. And so still trying to wash off some of the tar that I've got on me on one of those meetings. But the smaller acreage are identified as de minimis pumpers. De minimis pumpers are someone who uses less than 2 acre feet per year on their property. Their property could be an acre, a half acre, or even 5. And so the de minimis pumpers right now aren't as affected as the rest of the groups are. Eventually, we'll end up in talk with those folks again, and it may be that we might have to require meters. The Act itself gives us a toolbox of different things to utilize, and meters is one of those. So we have outreach to those folks. And the disadvantaged communities, they hold the seat on our board. And so what we've done is we've looked at all the smaller communities that are listed or identified as disadvantaged communities, DACs for short, and we've created a seat so they have a seat at the table and they actually vote on whatever policies or whatever direction the board is going. So we try to be all inclusive. We do a tremendous amount of outreach. This is part of it as well too. And so we're going to continue to do that. The Act requires us to do that.
Well, there's so much to talk about with this issue. I wish we had more time, but thank you so much for being here and giving our listeners at least a sense of what's happening across the Valley. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
And that's today's Valley Edition. You can hear all this and more on our website, kbpr.org. You can also download the podcast and find us on Twitter and Facebook.
Don't forget to check out our app. It's called KVPR, and it's available for free on iTunes and Android. The show is produced by the KVPR news team, Alice Daniel, Carrie Klein,
Monica Velez, and Laura Satsui. Technical support from Marv Allen and Don Weaver. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Monica Velez. This has been Valley Edition. Thanks for listening.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, committed to a California where all low-income workers have the power to advance economically. Learn more at irvine.org. The California Endowment. Health happens when Californians value schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, helping low-income Californians get the healthcare they need. On the web at chcf.org.